RPG Lessons Learned. When the game is over, when your players are gone, that's when lessons are learned. We are at RPGLL Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, rpglpodcast@gmail.com, and check us out online at rpglessonslearned.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of RPG Lessons Learned, the show where you can learn from our mistakes. I'm here with Dusty. Dusty, how's it going?
Tanner, I am boss. How about you?
I'm Tanner. I forgot to introduce myself. Man, we call this show where you can learn from our mistakes. We have to start making more mistakes, I think. I think we're getting into a groove. We're having too many fun games. It's a good problem to have, but like, I don't know. Maybe we need to do some like romantic one-on-one role-playing games and like really make some mistakes and talk about that.
We'll call it Candlelit RPG.
Oh, there we go. But yeah, we have another banger today. Maybe not a banger for us, but a solid thumbs up. And I ran a little adventure called Aberrant Reflections for Dusty. Dusty, Aberrant Reflections is by Direct Sun Games, and that is the moniker of the person who wrote this. And it was like an old school puzzle dungeon.
So Tanner, I have to ask you. You handed me a map called Temple of the Fallen Star, but then the dungeon is called Aberrant Reflections. Do those two things go together, or did you like GM them together?
No, they do go together. So the site in the adventure is called the Temple of the Fallen Star, but the adventure itself on the cover is called Aberrant Reflections, maybe for better like SEO, I'm thinking, because I think Temple of the Fallen Star sounds way more generic than this dungeon is. This dungeon is a way more exciting than the name Temple of the Fallen Star, I think.
I had a great time with this dungeon.
Yeah, and the map is a cool map. The map credit is by somebody named Old School Jelly. So it's not a Dyson Logos map, which, you know, we all love Dyson maps, but it's nice to see other people making maps. And speaking of maps, right when this dungeon started, I handed you a map. I handed you a map of the dungeon. We're not doing any hex dungeons in this one, obviously, because this is a pre-written thing. Is that a big no-no?
Handing me the map? I don't think so. It was a very different dynamic because this map didn't feel like it had a lot hidden from me. Like, it's not just a layout of rooms. Well, we should cover it first of all, too, that you had an in-game reason to hand me a map. Like, I got this map from someone else who had been here. So it's a quote unquote in-game map, but there's a fair amount of detail on each room. Like there, I don't want to get into the room features, but like there's a room with fungus, for example, and there's mushrooms. There's, you know, what's clearly a little pond or puddle of water. There's clearly a treasure chest. There's clearly a sarcophagi. There's clearly statues. Like I can see a lot of features of the dungeon, and I think it's a different kind of dungeon crawl to hand me a map of the dungeon, and it was novel, but no, I don't think it was taboo. I don't think it was off-putting. I don't think it hurt the game. It was just a different kind of game. Unfortunately for you, I mean, we obviously played remotely because we play remotely. I was bent over the dungeon the whole time, so the only thing you saw on the webcam was the top of my head.
Hey, that's immersion, okay? If you're getting that into the dungeon. Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, we've talked so much in the past episodes about mapping and how we feel about that and how it can be a cool layer to add, but also a cool layer. Like, there was a time in this dungeon where you saw, like, this looks like a workshop and I need to get some stuff done. I think what I need is in that workshop. I want to go to that workshop. And, like, if you're mapping a dungeon from a blank page, that's not a decision you can make, right?
No, you have to find the workshop. You have to go through all the stuff and like find it and uncover it. And certainly that's realistic to exploring totally unknown territories, but certainly also there's historical precedent for someone handing someone else a map and saying, go figure this out. Here's the map.
So the big thing is that with this dungeon, the gimmick of this dungeon is that there are mirrors in this dungeon that reflect a different version of the dungeon in those mirrors. And eventually you can go back and forth between those. And a lot of the puzzles involve things that are in the mirror world versus in the actual world. So the dungeon really only had, the map I handed you only had half the information on it. The GM map, which I want to say another big shout out to old school Jelly who made this. It has like a black and white map, but then it has in bright purple all the stuff that's only in the mirror dimension of the dungeon. It's a really, really smart layout, I think. And it's very, very usable. I have nothing but nice things to say about this PDF of the adventure. It's all hyperlinked and everything. So like, I feel like I gave you just enough to get in trouble with, because, you know, you still had to pay attention and ask what was in these rooms, because the reflection version of the dungeon was different.
That's true. I thought when I realized what was going on with the mirrors that it was going to be like a link to the past, mm-hmm. where you have to keep going back and forth between the night world and the day world. And I don't know if that's actually what it was called. Forgive me, online people who are more into Link to the Past than I am. But it wound up being a lot more than that, because some of the objects I could interact with were linked to their objects in the other world. So there was also this element of you have to align circumstances in both your world and the mirror world to get certain things done. Mm-hmm. And that felt really fun.
So yeah, what did you think overall of the idea of a puzzle dungeon? Have you ever done like a strictly puzzle themed dungeon in an RPG before?
I haven't. I've done dungeons. Martin is great for running dungeons where you're going to make assumptions that are wrong and you have to revisit your assumptions. Martin is a wizard at that. I've certainly run and played in dungeons with puzzles. I've certainly played and run in dungeons with mysteries. I've certainly played and run in dungeons where you're just trying to figure out, like, almost archaeologically, what was this place? What's the purpose? But I've never played in a dungeon where it's pretty obvious what it is, and you're just, like the game missed, just untangling this one giant puzzle a piece at a time. It's you're trying to get to the mirror world, and then you get to the mirror world, you're trying to, I don't want to spoil the dungeon too much, you're just constantly picking at this Gordian knot of getting to the treasure in this dungeon by dealing with the mirrors and the objects that are in both worlds. I'd never done something like that before, and I really enjoyed it. It wasn't combat focused. It was fun to like pick my way through this intellectual puzzle.
I love that it gives you the treasure room is like the second room you find in the dungeon, because it's like good like game design and or like video game design, you know, like immediately show them what the prize is. And you are exploring the dungeon to find a way to get to that prize, you know? Yeah, and like you said, like puzzles in dungeons or in role-playing games in general can be so fraught, because so many great puzzles that are in escape rooms and things like that do not translate to us standing around and talking over a map, you know? Like really physical, tactile puzzles, like ciphers, like stuff like that, like it's really kind of tricky. Like this dungeon was about trying to figure out how to bring one object, without spoiling it, it's basically about trying to figure out how to bring one object from one side of the dungeon to the other side of the dungeon, right?
And once you do that, everything kind of falls into place. Yes,
exactly. But like I feel like so many GMs think of what would be a cool puzzle in real life, and those do not translate, like a cool puzzle box, you know, like those are fun to do in real life, I guess. Fun is, you know, with an asterisk, but like that doesn't translate well to saying my Elminster the wizard does the puzzle box. Can you describe what it is, GM? And, you know, like it just doesn't like work. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Playing D&D is a game of maps and exploring and making the puzzle directly related to the map and moving an object from one place to another is a stroke of genius.
Yep. We had, I ran this dungeon for my 5e group as well, and I ran it in 5e, and they had a really good time with it as well. But I did that before I ran it for you, and you got pretty stumped in a couple of places. Do you think puzzles are harder in one-on-one games? Because my theory is that in my regular group where I have four players, I have four people spitting ideas to each other and they kind of decide on a good one and explore that. But like, I can't really give you hints as the GM when it's just you and me. Like, is that tough? Did you ever feel like really like, God, I just don't know what I'm supposed to do here?
I never felt frustrated. I felt anxious. And there's a difference. I told you this after the dungeon, after it was over. I felt like I wanted you to think I was smart, and then every time I got stumped, you were like, God, Dusty's an idiot. And I knew that you weren't. I know that you're a kinder person than that. But when you're the only person trying to puzzle something out and you don't have other people to fall back on and it's all on you, it's the same feeling as like taking a test in middle school. You have this just massive, I'm going to say performance anxiety. Please, listening at home, don't snicker. Like listen to it in the intention of which I'm saying. I feel this massive performance anxiety to like look smart in front of my friend Tanner. That's emotionally what I felt when I got stumped, not frustrated.
Yeah, it's almost like you're having like one-on-one time with like a tutor after class for like math homework or something. There's some pressure there, even if there's just one other player with you, right?
Yeah, and you know they know the answer, and you're trying to figure out the answer, and you're hoping they just don't think you're stupid. I encountered that, but I think that's a healthy feeling. I think we play games to feel emotions. I think we play games to stretch ourselves. I don't think we play games to be the smartest and the coolest and the best. I think we play games to overcome obstacles. So this was another form of that. And even though it was a little bit uncomfortable, I think if I played, you know, three more puzzle dungeons, I would enjoy them. And I think I'd get comfortable with that anxiety.
Yeah, that's a really good point. A lot of people, when they talk about the magic of RPGs, like you said, it is about overcoming obstacles, you know, in the fiction, whether that's monsters or puzzles or environments or stories or intrigue or things like that. But like, that only works if the obstacle is an obstacle. It sounds kind of stupid, but like, you know, the sense of triumph really can only come if the obstacle was a real stumper.
Agreed.
This puzzle had red herrings in it. And I even toned them down from when I ran them with my other players because they found the red herrings a little bit too strong. So I'm like, I'm going to tone this down, but still there were these red herrings. There were a lot of items that you could find in seemingly important looking places that looked important that were utterly irrelevant and were just treasure. So how did you feel about maybe red herrings in general with puzzles and then specifically like their implementation in this dungeon?
I try to avoid statements like always or never, but I'm gonna make one. I think you should almost never put red herrings into a dungeon. And here's why. There's so much of a gap between what the player is envisioning and what the GM is envisioning. When you play D&D, especially when you're playing Theater of the Mind and there's no map on the table, there's such a gulf. Like you describe a sarcophagus and maybe I'm picturing a gold sarcophagus and you're picturing a stone sarcophagus or granite. Stephen King talks about this in On Writing. He talks about describing a rat in a cage, and like one person might picture like a bird cage and someone else might picture one of those clear plastic cages like in a lab. And he says you have to, as a writer, give the details that are important and just be comfortable with people filling in their own details when it's not important. And I've loved that lesson that I took from On Writing, and that gulf is real. And that disparity of what the word sarcophagus means to you and to me, or the word stone floor, words stone floor means to you and to me, vaulted ceiling. Like these are the same concepts. We would both look at a real vaulted ceiling and say it's a vaulted ceiling. But when you say the word vaulted ceiling, not in the presence of a vaulted ceiling, we picture two different things. That gulf is so vast that I'm going to invent plenty of red herrings on my own.
Yep.
I don't need the designer of the dungeon helping me with red herrings that are written into the damn dungeon to make that gulf even worse.
I think realizing that gulf is like one of the very key stepping stones in the path of becoming a better GM or a better player. And everybody knows this. If you would point this out, if you took a guy who, or a girl or a person who ran one session of 5e D&D for the first time, and you told them, hey, what you're imagining and what the player's imagining are two different things, they would of course agree with you. Right. And they'd say, yeah, like, of course, that's how imaginations work. But understanding the implications of that, I think, is like such an important skill when it comes to becoming a more advanced or intermediate GM, that I'm glad you pointed that out, because like that understanding that is so, so important. And that even comes to things like outside of puzzle dungeons. Like in the past, I've run a lot of like intrigue based games, you know, and when somebody, a character is just being mysterious, like players will run with that in three different directions, you know, like, oh, he's trying to kill us. Oh, he has a crush on us. Oh, he's has a secret agenda or something. I'm like there's room for being mysterious and ambiguous, but like it's almost always better to give more detail than less, almost always. And like you said, my GM advice, I don't think is black and white, like you were saying. I try not to say always or never, but yeah, like give the information that they need and like they will figure out ways to make it more complicated no matter what you do. You don't need to write in the complications in that regard.
Agree. And it's ironic because in the Mystery Dungeon, Motor City Greens and Blues, or Blues and Greens, that you ran for me, that you wrote and ran for me, there was a red herring. And we were like, you know, one red herring in an investigation is perfect. but that's an investigation.
Yeah.
In a dungeon where everything is ambiguous, that's where I would say almost never put red herrings.
Yeah, because like in that setting, like we were playing in a historical real city, obviously a fictional version of that city, but like the laws of nature applied to that city, and the law, your expectations on what crime and stuff was, worked in that city. But like a dungeon is an alien space. It's a fun house. Like you're going into a different dimension, especially in this one, and you just kind of have to roll with what you see. And so
that's a great point that you're making about it being a modern city in Detroit, in Motor City Greens and Blues, is maybe whether or not you put red herrings has a lot to do with how vast that gulf that we described is.
Yeah.
The vaster the gulf, the more you do not put red herrings. But if the gulf is pretty narrow and we can be reasonably certain that we're picturing very close to the exact same thing, then red herrings really help.
Yeah. And I think it comes down to expectations, like you said, for the setting and what kind of game you're running for your players and things like that. But yeah, there are very few instances in which I would bend or break that rule. I think that's a really good point.
What were some of the key differences? So this discussion all came from you asking me, was it tough to play a puzzle dungeon one-on-one? What key differences did you experience as a GM running this adventure for one person versus a group?
I think part of it was the groups, I think, have a bigger willingness to experiment with things sometimes. Let's just say one of my players was willing to go into the claustrophobic flesh tunnel and see what happened. But when you're playing one-on-one, that's an entirely, you, Dusty, know if I go in the claustrophobic flesh tunnel and I don't come out, that's the end of our session for tonight. But like I have four different players with four different personalities, and one of them, she wanted to jump in there. So like, I think that's cool. And like the more different kinds of people you have at your table, the more different kinds of stuff are going to happen, you know? And I also had players, you were playing a dwarf, stabby stone slate skull, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Your dwarf could not for the life of him disentangle any of the magic effects going on. But I had players who had effects like detect magic and the Arcana skill as it exists in 5e D&D. So like they were able to get kind of a better idea of what, not like the solution to a puzzle, but like they can look at the runes on the floor and get an idea for what they're for, where Stabby Stone Skull, your dwarf, had no idea.
So you and I play on Friday nights after work. When we do play, we play on Friday nights after work. And then, you know, we start our weekend the next day doing fun weekend stuff with our families. Can I tell you what my biggest regret was when I woke up Saturday morning about this dungeon?
That you didn't kill more things?
No, it's what you just said about, hey, you were like, hey, Dusty, you were playing a dwarf. I woke up Saturday morning and I was like, that was a fun dungeon. But you know who played that dungeon? Dusty. That wasn't Stabby Slate Skull the dwarf. That was Dusty the human. I didn't make a lot of character choices as Stabby. I don't know if it's a puzzle dungeon thing or just a me not getting out of my way and like having more fun as Stabby. I think Stabby might have gone into the flesh tunnel, but Dusty didn't. And I regret that I didn't give Stabby more room to run.
So we've said this before, but I think we're in agreement. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that old school games are more about the setting than the characters, if that makes sense, like your personalities and things like that. Obviously, those are great things to motivate you to do certain things, but like once you're in the dungeon, the game is kind of about the dungeon and less about what your character thinks of the high elves or whatever. I think you just, once you realize that this dungeon was a puzzle, I think you had to rev up the Dusty puzzle solving part of your brain, and you had to rev down the role playing as a dwarf part of your brain. Yeah. And we only have so much bandwidth in our mind, right? So I don't want you to feel bad about that. If you feel like you would have wanted to do it differently, that's totally valid. I just don't think that you should feel bad for the way that you played it.
I just feel like I should have put somewhere on my screen as we played together, WWSD. What would Stabby do?
That's hilarious. So this was a very puzzle focused dungeon. You had, I think, like one or two combats, maybe one of them was more of a murder that you did.
Accurate.
Yeah. I think he maybe had one other like initiative role or something.
You're forgetting the mimic that almost cleaned my clock.
Oh yeah. Maybe we should talk about the mimic, but I mean, did this dungeon in general need more other stuff to balance it out? Did it need more role-playing or exploration or tactical combat? Was it too puzzly?
No. If we did two of these back to back, I would say yes.
Okay.
But I think it's okay. You know what? It's like movies. I think every movie has a tiny bit of everything. But I don't need the epic Jane Austen romance and the Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, double wielding M16s and the political intrigue of, I don't know, a John Grisham legal thriller in one movie. That would be exhausting. But I think John Grisham having a little bit of romance and a little tiny bit of action, like one chase or something, that's a good balance. And that's what this was. This was 85% puzzle, 15% physical space combat stuff. And yeah, that's enough of a mix to be entertaining. If you evened it out or crammed more combat in, it would have been exhausting. So you can have genres of dungeon like you have genres of movies and just let it be the puzzle genre.
Yeah, just make sure to switch up the genres for your audience and what they want, right?
Was that a thing that you were really worried about? Were you worried like, gosh, Dusty's not having a lot of combat?
Well, my 5e players, I don't know if it's because I rolled random encounters differently or they picked more fights as, you know, kind of fifth edition characters are want to do. They have lots of cool powers. They want to do things to people. But they had, I think, probably about triple the amount of combat that you did. And I don't think that it felt better or worse, but it was a difference that I noticed.
I'm gonna make a value judgment. It's gonna be controversial, but I'm still gonna do it.
Uh-oh, Uncle Dusty is at Thanksgiving table.
That's right. Cover your ears. No, in all seriousness, I think it has to do with the systems. I think 5e as a system encourages combat. All the rules are about combat. Everything in your character sheet's about combat. I think 5e is just a more combat friendly game because you have more hit points and more abilities, and a more combat focused game because you have more abilities. Whereas old school, like, I've got one or two combat abilities. I can swing my sword or I can stab with my dagger. And that's really it. Right. So there's not the same impetus to get into combat in older school systems. I think that's part of the change. But also it is personality, Tanner. You've played with me long enough to know that just personally, I don't default to combat as a way out of the situation.
Yep. But Stabby would do a murder if he thought it was the right idea for about 5 seconds.
Stabby did do the murder. He was confident. Well, I don't want to spoil anything.
He had reason to be suspicious, but I don't know. I can't get behind what he did. So speaking of system stuff, this is the first time for you playing a version of the Black Hack. Did that leave an impression on you at all?
I enjoyed it. I told my wife before we played that we were playing the Black Hack, and she's like, well, what's different about that? And I was like, oh, it is she's like, she, what, she didn't actually say what's different about it. She actually said, is that just D&D with a different name? Cause I described some games to her like that. And I was like, no, this is completely different. It's roll low. Mm-hmm. You same stats, but you roll a D20 and you're trying to roll under, you know, if your strength score is 18, you're rolling your D20. If you get less than 18, you succeed. I described it to her and she's going to, she was like, God, that'd be a really difficult mental switch to flip. And it really was not.
Mm.
I found rolling low to be very intuitive. I think part of it, it's again, because you and I have been playing old school systems, and in BX and basic expert, you want to roll low on a D6 if you're trying to listen at a door or if you're trying to win initiative. You want to roll low in situations in old school play. So the roll low part of my brain has been recently worked out, as well as the roll high part of my brain. So I thought it was a very easy transition, man.
Yeah, and one notable thing about Black Hat characters as opposed to other old school games is that you're way more durable. You have the ability to just completely soak hits with your armor. And it's a little bit of a fiddly mechanic. I'm sort of hacking together my favorite version of all these games that we've played together. Like, we use some Scarlet Heroes inspired solo player rules with the Black Hack, which don't come attached to it by default. I use the spell list from Knave, which I'm in love with. So like, this was definitely my version of the Black Hack. But yeah, the idea of like rolling low is, I think it's genius. I had a player, I ran my entire Hot Springs Island campaign in the Black Hack several years ago, and I had a player describe the Black Hack as the platonic ideal of role-playing game systems, which is such an insane thing to say. But I don't know if I've talked about this publicly or with you, Dusty, but this is my favorite old school D&D. This is my favorite Dungeons and Dragons, the Black Hack. Like, everything I write, every time I read or think about old school games or settings or dungeons, I'm thinking about the Black Hack. That's the game I'm thinking about. And so like, it has such an awesome community of people making their own hacks and other like modular things that you can slap together. It is a DIY RPG, you know? I mean, it's runnable right out of the box, but at the same time, like, people are making, you know, modules for it and everything. So like, it is my favorite Dungeons and Dragons. I don't know if I've made that clear to you yet.
Maybe you've said it, but this is the first time it's registering with me.
Yeah.
But I think it's the first time you said it too. Little did I know all those years ago, and I was like, hey, there's this game called Kaigaku. It's based on this other game called The Black Hack. Mm-hmm. Little did I know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the Legend of the Five Rings inspired version of The Black Hack.
Dude, that's awesome. I have to ask you, I've got to go back a few topics. You said you couldn't get behind it. Did I shock you when I had Stabby kill that magician that I thought was one of the bug people?
No, you didn't shock. I mean, it amused me. It didn't shock me. I don't think... listen, if you're in a weird dungeon and there's no rules, there's no cops around, and some guy looks like his skin is falling off and he's a bug underneath that skin, you got to do what you got to do. That's what I think.
I just feel guilty. Those of you at home, I was wrong.
Yeah. Well, tell it to the judge.
Yep.
Yep. Black Hack, we like it. So kind of going back to the dungeon, how would you have run this dungeon differently were you me? You've had some time to think about it. And I remember us talking, this dungeon is, if I really had to simplify it, it is kind of a big ring. And when my players did it, they went around the ring clockwise and they did not have an issue with the puzzles. And you went around it counterclockwise and you didn't discover the tools you needed to solve the dungeon until the very end. And so a lot of the puzzles that were presented to you, you were like, there's something to do here, but I don't feel like I have what I need to do it. Right.
Yeah. And I think you, at the time, after we finished and we're kind of doing our brief postmortem after the fact, there's this one portcullis.
Oh, and yes.
And you gave me a roll to lift that portcullis. And I think, this is not me blaming you at all. It's a lesson that I've had to learn so many times when I've played. Sometimes I'll change the rules or just let players go with something, and then I give them enough rope to like hang both of us.
Mm-hmm.
if you would have, I'm not criticizing your call, if you would have said, oh, that portcullis is locked into place mechanically, I'd have been like, oh, okay. And then I would have had to go clockwise. The other
way. Yep.
So if I was running it differently, I don't know. I would treat that portcullis as something that needs to be locked.
Yeah.
And maybe the designer did that on purpose, where like the portcullis is there for a reason to get you going in the right direction. If that was the case, what I would have done differently as the designer is I would have had a note on that portcullis saying, be warned, if you open this and players explore beyond the portcullis from this direction, they're very likely to get lost and frustrated. But I think for me, it all stems from the moment I was able to go counterclockwise.
Yep. And like I said, I made that call at the time, and in both games that happened, I should say, so at both times I ran this, I made that call at the time because I don't think that, I mean, like, one of the things that strength does in D&D is bend bars and lift gates. Like that's what it does, you know? So I didn't want to say no if you tried to do that, and I let you roll, and Stabby had a decent strength, and he did it. So, like, maybe I should have given you disadvantage on it or something, but, no, like...
you're right. There is a bend iron bars, because that's a D10 roll, right?
Yeah.
You're 1,000% right. So I guess I'm going to put this squarely on the designer. That should have been a big stone slab door, just like the one into the room with the bell.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. Cause I think once you see a portcullis, I mean, you and I are both men about town. We see portcullises all over the place.
Absolutely.
And every time I see one, I'm like, I want to bend that. Can I sneak in? Can I squeeze through those bars? Can I jam something in there? Can I lift it? What's the mechanism? And like all those questions go away if it's a big stone door.
Yeah. When I see a portcullis, I just think I've got a 1 in 10 chance of bending those bars.
Yep. Still waiting for that day.
Yep. I'm up to 9 portcullises. So,
law of averages. Yeah.
Gambler's fallacy says the next portcullis I encounter, I'm going to be able to bend.
Yeah. It would be stupid not to. You're on a hot streak now.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would change that part about the design too. I would make that a more impermeable, less enticing barrier to try to mess with, I guess.
Yeah. And if you have a skill on the character sheet called bend iron bars, then don't put iron bars in the dungeon in a place where you need that to be impassable for the design to work.
Right. And it's not like it was keeping you from a big dragon on the other end that could have killed you or some other danger. It was a portcullis that beyond it lied your frustration. And I think it's okay to wall that off as opposed to like that's not trying to protect Stabby the character. That was to try to protect Dusty the player from frustration. So it's okay to wall that off a little bit harder, I think.
That's fair.
Yeah. Maybe the designer intended this dungeon to be solved in more ways, but having played it twice, I think there's kind of one way to so the designer puts notes in here, and they talked about, they have a whole section actually about adjudicating solutions, and I want to read it to you. It says, PCs can try anything, encourage out-of-the-box solutions. Let PCs attempt an idea if it even has a chance of success. It says, in playtesting, one group never retrieved the gauntlet at all. They manipulated objects in the mirror dimension through the corpse attached to the key. These are things that will make sense to Dusty, maybe not to you, which blows my mind. I feel like this is a very linear. I feel like there's one right way to solve this, and every other way seems frustrating.
Yeah, I think playtesting is invaluable. But when you are the creator of the dungeon and you're the one playtesting it, you have inbuilt a whole thousands of scenarios of adjudication because you're the one that created it and yep. You know the solution. But if someone else is running your creation, that's when I think the solutions narrow down to one. But it really sounds like we're bagging on the designer. And again, I want to reiterate, I really enjoyed this. This was super fun. The anxiety I felt was a fun anxiety. Overcoming it was fun. Finally solving it was a feeling of elation, which again, mm-hmm. We play dungeons to feel emotions. I don't want it to carry the stone door thing so far that people think, oh God, they hated Aberrant Reflections, when the opposite is true. I loved it. It's wonderful. It has exactly, in my opinion, one flaw. And I aspire to make a dungeon with exactly one flaw.
That'd be great if each of my dungeons could only have one. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. One thing I want to call out as well as a positive is that this dungeon has a built-in hint system in it in terms of Isaac, the ghoul.
Ooh, yes.
And the hints come at a price. Luckily, you did a murder so that you could pay that price a little bit easier. But I think that that is very, it's so tempting as a GM to want to like give little hints and tweak things and guide the players if they feel like they're stumbling. But once you present them with like, as a designer, presenting the GM with a hint system that has rules, I think is such a better practice than the GM feeling like they have to fudge the puzzle.
And I feel like Isaac has legs. Like, even though he's a ghoul, I really like him. And I have that book where mm-hmm. Isaac and I can exchange messages and he wants to know about the outside world since he's magically locked in that room. I feel like Stabby is really going to make an effort to make that happen out of some empathy for Isaac. So whether you intended it or not, to the extent that we play Stabby again, Isaac is going to figure in.
He knows, he has approximate knowledge of many things. Yeah. So to wrap it up, we both liked it. We really did. I think it's easier to talk about the negatives and try to diagnose solutions to that than enthuse about what's positive. And I think that's just kind of a human thing, right? Or at least a me and you kind of thing. But lesson learned number one, design a puzzle for your dungeon that fits your format. The format for old school play is papers, pencils, and a map. And this puzzle relied on the map the entire time. It relied on the tool that you guys had in front of you, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, I tried to do the same thing with the Christmas dungeon, where the two realms were mirrors of each other. Like the reindeer stables were in the mirror position of the dire wolf kennel. Mm-hmm. So I've played with that concept before of making the map the puzzle, but you're right. This, I hadn't done that consciously, and this drives it home. And going forward, I will do that consciously.
Yeah, if you're playing a different type of game, you know, if you're playing a more social intrigue focused game and your players have lots of notes about NPCs and the relationships between them, make the puzzle around that. Like, make the puzzle around the tools that you're already playing with in general. It doesn't just have to be maps. Lesson learned number two, Dusty.
Almost never put red herrings in your dungeon and base your decision on how wide you perceive the gulf between your envisioning of the dungeon and the player's envisioning of the dungeon to be.
And then lesson learned number three, if you are an intermediate GM and you feel like doing this, hack your system, make it work for your table. This is my version of the Black Hack. It has bits and pieces plucked from my favorite other old school games. The great thing about old school games, Dusty, they're pretty much all compatible with each other. You know, it's like downloading like Doom mods or something. Like they all just work. They're built in the same code. You know what I mean?
They are. And that's great.
Yep. So just Frankenstein your favorite game together for the tastes of you and your table. And it'll be enriching.
And to that, I would add, if you're a beginning GM, hack the system, but say these magic words. Hey, for the rest of the session, because then you as a GM have all the freedom that you need to keep the game at your table moving, and you're not committing to a rule for all time when it may not be the most designed rule. You're just trying to overcome the situation. So, hey guys, you know what? For the rest of the session, we're not going to worry about encumbrance because you have access to this donkey, and I'm just going to assume that you're using it intelligently. Hey guys, you know what? For the rest of the session, this. Hey guys, you know what? For the rest of the session, say that as a beginning GM, if you're worried about some player six sessions from now going, but you said we didn't have to worry about encumbrance anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And it's good to say at the top of the session so that any changes that you make aren't surprises. They should be, you know, changes that everybody on the table is at least aware of, if not on board with.
Yeah, but I agree. Hack your system.
Yep. That was Aberrant Reflections. Dusty, thank you for playing. It was a little bit of a head scratcher, but I'm glad we got through it and we had some good times.
I really enjoyed it.
Awesome. Thank you, everybody, and take care.
People call them postmortems, evaluations, appraisals, reviews, retrospectives. We call them lessons learned, and we're sharing ours with you.